I honestly believe that Bernardo Arevalo and Karin Herrera will be able to initiate the change. I think change will take a lot of work. They're inheriting a house in shambles and a country in shambles with huge social problems, inequalities, and torn down state that does not guarantee nor safety, nor health, nor education, nor all basic services. So the challenge is enormous. But I think they're up to this challenge. But very importantly, and probably the most important factor, is the level of consciousness of the people of Guatemala. And I think the people voted, the young people in the cities, but especially the mobilizations that Lucia was mentioning of the indigenous peoples. This was a sign of strength. And I think against this, those that have ruled the country in the past know that they cannot defeat them. That this is a time, as indigenous people said, we're not struggling for one election. We're not struggling for one victory. We're struggling to save democracy and to have them respect our vote. Now, obviously, those that are against Bernardo and the transition to democracy went to the very last day, as we all know now, was that long session of 9 hours in Congress, went to the very last day trying to stop the transition, but were not able to do it. So I think this is a moment of real hope in Guatemala. But it's a hope because of the transition. It's a hope because for the first time we have an honest and good government. But it's also a hope because the people mobilized. And this is a victory of the people of Guatemala, especially the indigenous people.
And Frank, we don't have much time, but I just wanted to ask you in terms of what you would expect from the United States government. Previous U.S. governments have always backed the corrupt elite of Guatemala in maintaining power. What is your hope now with this new administration that you would expect from the Biden administration and from Washington?
Well, we would hope full support. As a matter of fact, the U.S. and the international community, the OAS included, which doesn't necessarily have that good a record in the past either, or the European Union, everyone supported the transition. I think it came to the point where everyone recognized that Guatemala was about to collapse, to implode, if it kept on going in that direction, and that the only way to rescue it was to rescue democracy. And I think everyone has put their support behind Bernardo Arevalo, Karin Herrera, and the Semilla party in government. And I think this is important. Now, I think this support has to continue. One of the things that Bernardo said in his speech is, we thank the international community, but please don't forget us. Coming to power is only but the first step. And in reality, he said, a very initial step of what has to be a long process. Please continue with us for the long term. Now, obviously, we're linked to the different policies. This administration in Washington has made the right statements, had taken the right position. But we do remember was the past administration, was the Trump administration, that is, was the moment when CC, a good experiment on justice, was attacked by the elites. And the Trump administration turned their face away and let it collapse. This is very tragic. So it's very, very crucial to understand that policies from Washington have an indirect effect in how much the elite over there thinks they can get away with.
Finally, Lucia Istiu, in Spain, though you'd like to be in Guatemala, though safe in Guatemala, we have less than a minute, but your final demands as this transition is made to the new Arevalo administration?
Well, right now, we are organized as migrant and exiled people in Europe, and we are in contact with networks for migrants in U.S. too. So we have our own demands. We exist, and we are vital for the country, even if the state forced to leave the country because of a lot of reasons. We have our demands, and we want to speak to the government of Bernardo, and we want to, and Karin, and we want to be here. We want to speak, and we want to let them know what we want, and we want rights, and we want to recognize us as persons, even as migrant communities and exile people outside the country, because we are vital. We create a big intensity activity and campaign for in Advocacy International in Europe and in US, and our work was vital for the Democracy Now in the country too.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Lucia Eschu is exiled K'iche indigenous leader now in Bilbao, Spain, and Frank LaRue, Guatemalan human rights activist and lawyer, speaking to us from Guatemala City. We'd like to ask both of you to stay after the show so we can conduct our interview in Spanish and put it online at Democracy Now! En Español. Next up, we get an update on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza as the UN Secretary General and rallies worldwide demand a ceasefire. Back in 20 seconds.
Crecen los versos que entintan esperanza. La abuela Ishmukanete teje melodías al alma, sin color ni distinción. Los pueblos bailan y cantan. Somos viento, somos sol y sueños multicolores. Somos este norte, oscuro este. Somos historia, viento y canción. Escribimos el
Sara Kuricich. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Major rallies calling for a ceasefire in Gaza were held worldwide this week and marking 100 days of the Israeli assault on Gaza. Those rallies included one in Washington, D.C., where organizers say 400,000 people protested U.S. complicity in what they called one of the deadliest and most destructive military assaults in recent history. Palestinian health officials say Israeli attacks have killed 158 civilians in Gaza over the last 24 hours alone, bringing the death toll since October 7th to 24,000, though this is likely an undercount. The majority of those killed, women and children. It's believed more than 10,000 children have died. On Sunday, President Biden put a statement marking 100 days since the October 7th Hamas attack and condemned Hamas for continuing to hold more than 100 hostages. But he made no mention of the tens of thousands of Palestinians killed, injured, or displaced during Israel's bombardment. On Monday, United Nations humanitarian leaders issued a joint demand for dramatically increasing the flow of aid into Gaza. This is the World Food Program's Palestine Country Director, Samer Abdeljaber.
Everyone in Gaza is hungry. We're exploring all possible solutions, but none are sufficient in the face of obstacles. There are people starving in areas, and we are not able to give basic food for. The needs are rising faster than we are able to respond. We need to be able to bring in more supplies, and we need safe access to reach people everywhere in Gaza, not just those who are close to the borders. We need a long-lasting ceasefire to stop the suffering.
For more, we're joined by Dr. Omar Abdelmanan, pediatric neurologist, co-founder of Gaza Medic Voices and Health Workers for Palestine, in constant touch with his colleagues in Gaza, joining us from London. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us. The assault this weekend, especially in the central and south part in Khan Yunis, is intense, with well over 100 Palestinians killed just in the last 24 hours. Can you talk about the desperation of people there and what you think could lead to a ceasefire, as millions around the world demanded one this weekend?
Thank you so much for having me on the program. So the situation is spiraling out of control. Many of our colleagues, British doctors who have just come out of Gaza in the last few days, led by Medical Aid Palestinians, have come out and said the scenes inside the hospitals are apocalyptic, to say the least. They described scenes inside Al-Aqsa Hospital, which is no longer functioning and has been completely taken over and besieged by the Israeli occupation forces. They described scenes of 500 admissions in a night, many of whom were serious casualties from air raids, the majority of whom were children, children with double above-the-knee amputations of the lower limbs, children with burns down to the bone that are so horrific that they are disfigured for life, and also women and men also being killed and targeted. What we are seeing is a systematic targeting of healthcare facilities. Healthcare workers, 370 at least at the last count, of whom have been killed, being either killed, maimed, abducted, or even more so tortured when they've been held captive. As Dr. Ghassan Abusetta mentioned on the rally in London on Saturday, these are the reports coming outside from there. What we are seeing is not a war on children. This is a genocidal, uncontrollable massacre of Palestinians at large and in mass. The Israeli occupation forces and the Israeli government has made it very clear that they are now in a situation where they want to either exterminate Palestinians or force them and displace them out of their ancestral home after 75 years of occupation. And what would lead to a ceasefire? Well, the simple answer is the American government. President Biden, when he comes out and says on a national address, 100 days of the 7th of October, he feels for the hostages and the families. We all feel terrible about the situation on the 7th of October. But to completely nullify and ignore the tens of thousands, at least 24,000 Gazans who have been killed in cold blood by an Israeli war machine is frankly outrageous. Frankly, the US government and the UK government and other Western leaders are complicit in this because they are arming the same Israeli bombs that are raining hellfire on Palestinian hospitals, Palestinian schools, Palestinian bakeries and water sanitation plants. Make no mistake, this is an attempt to completely wipe out an infrastructure and a public health system for people in Gaza.
But doctor, I wanted to ask you, there have been about an estimated 15,000 children born in Gaza since the assault began. Could you talk about the impact on pregnant women with the collapse of all of these medical facilities?
So we had an obstetrician that was with this WHO team that just came out of Al-Aqsa. What she described to us and speaking to colleagues on the ground is women giving birth in the shelters, in the rubble, in the streets, with no maternity care for women who are pregnant in the north and central regions of Gaza. That is at least a million people with no access to maternity care. That means women having to go through high-risk pregnancies, having to go through deliveries with no hospital or pre-hospital care, no midwives, no doctors to help. What that has led to is many, many women dying in childbirth or after, from the normal complications that often happen after a high-risk pregnancy. That includes hemorrhage, where they would not be able to have a blood transfusion because of the lack of supplies. That includes women fitting, having seizures, and no medication being given to them to stop these seizures. This is medieval-style medicine that we are seeing, and this is 100% man-made. Again, this could stop right now if there was a permanent and lasting ceasefire. And unfortunately, as I said, the UK, the US, has continued to warmonger and to actually allow Israel to continue in this genocidal tactics. And the global south has started to mobilize. And there has been a great awakening for people who were before not aware of the situation in Palestine. But 70 years of occupation now fast forwarded and sped up at double speed with this genocidal attacks has led to people protesting in the hundreds of thousands across London, Washington, D.C., and other major cities. And as healthcare workers, myself included, speaking on behalf of Health Workers for Palestine and Gaza Medic Voices, we do not accept this. We will not remain silent. We have escalated and will continue to do so. And as a concerned citizen of the world, what we are seeing is a lack of humanity, a lack of response from our leaders who are impotent, frankly. And now it is the duty of citizens like us to stand up, to protest, to approach our members of parliament to put pressure on our governments to act. And if that doesn't happen, then the next step, which should be happening now, is to boycott any Israeli product that is funding a state that is destroying people and killing human beings in their homes, to apply pressure for academic sanctions, for cultural boycott, academic boycott, and sanctions on the Israeli state. And this is the next step, and this is what I'm calling for as a consensus, and to my fellow colleagues, health workers, and general citizen professionals and non-professionals across the world, to start standing up and start speaking up, because we have had enough. We are sick and tired of seeing our own colleagues being killed and maimed en masse.
Could Doctor, could you talk about your work trying to bring children to the UK for medical care from Gaza and the obstacles you faced?
So this is work that is being done by colleagues of ours. There are numerous projects that are attempting to bring children to European cities, to European hospitals, to provide care similar to what the PCRF, the Palestinian Child Relief Society, has been doing so well to the United States previous to the 7th of October. We are in discussions with the relevant bodies to try and make this happen. Many of these children are children who have had complex injuries as a result of direct bombardment and bombing, who need years of reconstructive plastic surgical work. And these will be specific cases that we will try to help where the need is not met in Egypt and Jordan or in neighboring countries. But this is, this is happening, but watch this space, essentially.
Finally, Dr. Omar Abdelmanan, you have Israel talking about this going on for more than a year. They are saying that Hamas has to release the hostages. Meanwhile, Hamas released a hostage video where one of the hostages is shown saying that two other hostages were killed in an Israeli strike. You have the mass protest of hostage families that took place over the weekend demanding that it be the first priority to release the hostages. What is your response to the Israeli government, to Netanyahu, and to the others in the war cabinet, saying first Hamas has to release all the hostages?
We've seen this narrative time and time again. Every interlude in this continued bombardment, we have seen the excuse of hostages, the excuses of human shields, the excuses of Hamas tunnels under hospitals, and many of these have been debunked by mainstream media. Well, the Washington Post, BBC News found that many of these tunnels underneath the hospitals were in fact, you know, previously used for as ventilation shafts. They're not even Hamas tunnels. So this idea of the hostages being released, as you correctly said, we are seeing the Israelis shooting at their own people. They shot two or three hostages waving white flags, who were Israeli hostages running and fleeing from their captives, and they were shot dead at point-blank range. So, frankly, to me and to all of us who have seen the demasking of the Israeli government's intentions, these are just purely excuses. And unfortunately, the mainstream media, many of whom are in the UK and the US, are complicit in this. They are allowing these narratives. When I go on every TV show and I get asked the first question, do you condemn Hamas? Or do you know about the tunnels underneath the hospitals? This is pushing that narrative forward. And frankly, you know, investigations so far, you know, in what remains of Gaza has shown that many of these stories, the majority of whom, are not true, simply not true. So that would be my response. And again, I am not, and we are not, you know, going to be taken for a ride by the Israeli government's narrative. We know exactly what is happening here. And the West and the UK and the US and other governments, as I said, are complicit in continuing this narrative. And until there is a permanent ceasefire, until there is proper humanitarian aid entering through aid corridors, until there is the end of the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and the continuing atrocities happening in the West Bank with settlers attacking Palestinians, then we will not stop and we will continue and we will mobilize in the hundreds of thousands, in the millions, against this genocide.
Dr. Omar Abdelmanan, we want to thank you for being with us, pediatric neurologist and co-founder of Gaza Medic Voices and Health Workers for Palestine, speaking to us from London. Next up, record low turnout and temperatures for an Iowa caucus. Donald Trump trounces his opponents and heads to New York to deal with yet another trial for the sexual assault of E. Jean Carroll, the New York writer. Stay with us. Heavens by Basil Zayed. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with the first caucus of the 2024 election cycle. Donald Trump has trounced his opponents in the Iowa caucus, winning by a landslide record 51% of the record low vote. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis narrowly topped former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, 21% to 19%. Vivek Ramaswamy suspended his campaign, endorsed Trump. Trump's victory came despite his mounting legal troubles and the fact that he's refused to debate his challengers. He's coming from Iowa to New York to the Manhattan federal court today for the second trial determining damages for sexually assaulting writer E. Jean Carroll before he joins other candidates in New Hampshire. For more, we go to Wisconsin, to John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent. He's been covering the Iowa caucus. What stood out for you most? A lot of records here. Record trouncing, 31 to 30% higher than the next candidate, right, DeSantis. Freezing cold weather, and now he's in court in New York.
It's quite a stack of records there, Amy. Thanks for having me. Look, what stood out for me as I walked the streets of Dubuque yesterday was that it was unbelievably cold. And I know cold pretty well as an upper Midwesterner. But they were talking in some parts of Iowa about a 30 to 40 below zero wind chill last night when the caucuses began. And I don't doubt that that may have depressed turnout to some extent. But I have to tell you, I did not see the sort of enthusiasm that I've seen in the past. And I've covered Iowa caucuses for decades. And so in many ways, it seemed as if the Republicans were kind of going through the motions. They were, you know, putting a period on the end of the sentence. Yes, they endorsed Donald Trump. Yes, some of the more urban and suburban areas leaned more toward Nikki Haley, especially who was rising, and to some extent to Ron DeSantis. But what stood out most for me was in some of the entrance polling. They do polls as people go into the caucuses. That, for a variety of reasons, is the best way to survey rather than traditional exit polling. And in that entrance polling, 32% of the people who attended the caucuses said that they believe that if Donald Trump was convicted of one of the 91 counts he faces in trials all over the country this year, if he is convicted, they would see him as unfit for office. That's a striking figure, Amy. It doesn't, it's higher than what we've seen in some polls. And in a state where you're talking about very conservative people coming to the caucuses, obviously they're engaged Republicans or Republican leaners, to have that high a level, I would suggest to you that when you combine that with some other national polls that point to similar concerns, that these trials of Trump may well turn out to be far more significant than a lot of political pundits assume. I think most of the pundits assume that Republicans are going to line up behind Trump no matter what, that, you know, whatever convictions he faces, whatever happens, they're unconcerned. this entrance polling suggests a very different reality. And if we continue to see this pattern going forward, I think, frankly, it's a compelling number or compelling set of numbers as you look toward November. It may well be that Donald Trump has more of a problem with Republicans than people thought.
Well, John, the presidential primary now, the primaries now shift to New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. What's your expectation in terms of any chances of some of these contenders against Trump to make any headway?
It all comes down to New Hampshire, and there's simply no question of that one. New Hampshire is the place where Nikki Haley has put all of her energy. I mean, she did go into Iowa, and she's got a lot of money behind her. She's got Koch brothers money, and you know, kind of a lot of the wealthy donor types tend to be very supportive of her, and not giving money directly to her, but doing independent expenditures. So she had a campaign in Iowa, but her focus has been primarily in New Hampshire. She's been going into very small towns in that state, really building out a serious campaign. Some recent polling has showed her closing in on Trump. With Chris Christie getting out of the race, a lot of his votes are likely to go to Haley. It's clear from Iowa that Haley does have an appeal in some of the more urban and suburban areas. You've got a lot more suburban areas in New Hampshire. And so that's where it's all at. If Haley beats Trump in New Hampshire, then you've got an ongoing race. I don't think that means that Trump won't be the nominee. I think he's got tremendous number of advantages in all sorts of states going forward. But New Hampshire will decide whether this is going to be any kind of realistic contest for that Republican nomination. And if Haley does win New Hampshire, then you do go to South Carolina, her home state. That'll be a big test for her. And, you know, we'll have more to talk about. On the other hand, if Trump does as well or anywhere near as well in New Hampshire as he did in Iowa, this race is going to fade away pretty quickly.
And meanwhile, President Biden has been raising lots of money. In the last quarter of 2023, his campaign raised over $97 million. He's begun now to get on the stump somewhat. Talk about what you see as Biden's chances, especially given his enormous involvement and support of the wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East and in Gaza. I'm sorry, the Israeli attacks on Gaza.
Yes. Look, Biden's got a lot of problems. You know, we're pointing to this exit or entrance poll data out of Iowa that suggests that Trump has problems with his own party. But the fact is that Biden's approval ratings are exceptionally low, and his polls against Trump put him, you know, at best even, sometimes behind, sometimes a little bit ahead. So he's got a hard, hard race ahead of him. And I don't think there's any question. I look at all the polling, and I spent a lot of time talking to people. I recently interviewed Rashida Tlaib about, you know, what's happening in Michigan. Look, there is simply no question. Joe Biden is harmed politically, I think, in a number of states by his ongoing support for the Israeli assault on Gaza. And you look at Michigan as an example. The polls recently out of Michigan have been very, very troubling for Biden. I hear that, you know, in coming days, he's going to try and make some efforts to reach out to Arab Americans, to reach out to communities that have been deeply concerned about this. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think rhetoric's going to help there. I think that only a change in policy is likely to begin to close some of the gap. So Biden's got a hard race ahead of him. What I would sum it up as, though, is, look, the level of people who in Iowa said that they would see a convicted Trump as unfit is an encouraging sign for Biden. The reality is that we're likely to have a very, very close November election. And when you get down to it, on both sides, it's going to be an issue of mobilization. And I think Trump will have perhaps some trouble mobilizing the whole of his Republican and conservative base. But Biden also will have trouble in that regard. And so we've got a long, complicated, and frankly, pretty frustrating race ahead of us.
And we're going to have to leave it there. And Nikki Haley is pouring money into new ads where she refers to the Trump-Biden nightmare. John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, speaking to us from Wisconsin, just back from Iowa. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM, and we wish you the best for the new year.